Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. All this week, we've been exploring Michigan's juvenile lifers. With more than 360 people who were convicted of murder when they were teenagers, our state has the second highest number in the nation. This large number certainly got our attention, and that was part of the impetus for this series. We're trying to better understand why Michigan has so many people in prison who were sentenced to mandatory life without parole as juveniles. Another reason we chose to devote time to this is that Michigan prosecutors have come under national scrutiny for their slow response and, some argue, outright resistance to the changes required by the Supreme Court. One of the loudest critics has been Deborah LaBelle. The Ann Arbor attorney directs the ACLU's Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative. She's suing the state to try to abolish life without parole sentences for all juveniles, arguing it's cruel and unusual punishment. Even with the recent Supreme Court rulings, juveniles can be sentenced to life in certain rare cases. We ask LaBelle to respond to many of the assertions we've been hearing all week from prosecutors. Cynthia Canty has this final interview in our series.
I want to start with this because, as you know, Attorney General Bill Schuette was a national leader opposing resentencing juvenile lifers. And in the Montgomery case, he filed an amicus brief on behalf of Michigan and 15 other states opposing letting all juvenile lifers be resentenced. We asked for an interview, and Attorney General Schuette declined our request. And instead, he referred us to Genesee County Prosecutor David Layton. And here's what David Layton said.
What I do think is correct is that ultimately the judge will make the decision. We are the kind of like the first line of defense, if you will. As ministers of justice, we decide whether to go forward with juvenile life without parole or with a term of years. Just because we recommend the juvenile life without parole doesn't mean the judge is going to make that determination. Ultimately, under Michigan sentencing law, the judge will make that call.
So the prosecutors are deferring to the judges in most of these juvenile lifer cases, some 60%, to make the decision. What do you think's wrong with this approach?
Well, I think you're the prosecutor. You don't get to punt to the judge. If you could do that in all cases, a prosecutor could go in and issue warrants for a whole room full of people saying, we're going to charge you all with, I don't know, loitering and trespassing, even though they know that there was only one person maybe who stepped on the trespass thing, and say, let the judge sort it out. A prosecutor has the obligation to, based upon the facts and the law, make a threshold showing as to why this person is irreparable. And aside from the immorality of it, as people sit for over a year, the cost to the taxpayers is unjustifiable. These trials, these Miller hearings in front of the court, whether they be by jury or judge, are going to be very expensive. They're going to be long. There will be experts. There'll be psychologists. There'll be brain treatments. And this money is borne by the county. And so to say, well, we're just going to file for all of them and we're not going to exercise our discretion, which under the rules of a prosecutor, they're obligated to exercise their discretion and to make sure that the person they're charging with and the sentence they're seeking is appropriate.
All the prosecutors with whom we spoke stressed the responsibility they feel, Deb, to victims and victims' families. Here's Muskegon County Prosecutor D.J. Hilson in his thoughts how victims' families factor into his decision whether to seek life without parole again or a term of years.
If they were of the opinion that they wanted to see this young lady at the time go away for the rest of her life, then that would be the course that we would follow. And if today they still have those strong feelings, I'm never going to go against my victim's family's wishes.
So it feels to me like there's almost a cultural component here that prosecutors are wired to advocate on victims' behalf. Isn't that their job?
No, I don't think it is their job. Prosecutors are elected by all of us. And they're under their ethical obligations. They are particular ministers of justice, and their obligations are certainly to listen to and respect the feelings of victims. But victims don't set the constitutional bar of what's appropriate sentence, and prosecutors are well aware of this. Prosecutors have an ethical obligation. It's set forth in their ethical duties that are specific to prosecutors that they can only pursue charges and sentences that have a probable cause and that they have a particular responsibility when it comes to sentencing because they are aware, uniquely aware, as their ethical obligations say, of disparities in sentences, of what sentences are given to one person as opposed to another. And you certainly can't say that this youth should spend the rest of their life in prison because that person has a victim's family who's opposed to release, as opposed to this other youth who may have committed the exact same crime, gets a term of years and gets to be released. It's not the victim's family that determines whether a youth gets an opportunity for release. It's whether the prosecutor can show by beyond a reasonable doubt that they are the rare and uncommon youth, not that's not forgiven by their victim family, but the rare and uncommon youth who is irreparable and can never be rehabilitated. That is the standard, and the prosecutors are eschewing their responsibility to all of us who they're responsible to society, to the court, and to their ethical obligations if they eschew all of those responsibilities in favor of one person who says, no, I want them to stay in prison for life.
It does seem that there's this tension and this kind of at odds with Michigan's laws on victims' rights. Let's take a listen to Genesee County Prosecutor Layton again.
You can't factor out the victims. And with all due respect to the United States Supreme Court, I don't think that it really factored in victims' rights when it made its decision. And because Michigan law and Michigan's Constitution requires us to factor that in, I think rightfully so. And I think correctly, all of the prosecutors who have these cases did so.
So it seems that I'm hearing Prosecutor Layton say, yes, the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court, but their rulings are in conflict with Michigan's laws on victims' rights. So how do prosecutors navigate this?
First, they should read the law. One, you can't have, with all due respect to the United States Supreme Court, when you say, but we're going to do it a different way. The United States Supreme Court rules, and it trumps Michigan law. And by the way, Michigan law, in fact, forbids a court from considering victims' comments in sentencing because we are not a vigilante system. A victim doesn't get to decide, and a victim may decide, particularly not victims' family or victims, may want the person to get the death penalty because you're so hurt and you're so angry at that time. But we are not a vigilante system. We follow the rule of law. And so their opinion as to what the appropriate sentence is simply not relevant, and there is nowhere in Michigan law where it is relevant. What is relevant is that they get their say. They get to be participants in the system. They get to be involved. That they get to do under the victim's rights. That has nothing to do with what's an appropriate constitutional sentence, and it has nothing to do with the prosecutor's obligations.
Deb, something that is so key to the Supreme Court decisions and to we've been touching around this, so let's get into this more, that in these juvenile lifer cases, centering around the definition of what is the rarest kind of juvenile offender and what exactly does irreparably corrupt or permanently incorrigible mean? In your view, how should this be determined? Where's the line?
You know, it may be like pornography. We know what it isn't. We know that a youth who is now served 30 years in prison and who hasn't had a misconduct in the last 15 years, for example, and is at the lowest custody level that they can possibly be in, who has taken every class they can possibly take and done well in them, who has become a mentor to other people, who has shown deep remorse and who has changed, who has lived their life in an authentic way in prison with no hope and then yet has become a person of trust, a person who has gained the support of corrections officers and wardens and the religious community, that person has been rehabilitated, that you can't show that they're incapable of it because they are the person they are. And for many of these youth, about a third of them, they didn't commit a homicide. And you have to look at what they actually did. The Supreme Court said you really do have to look at their participation. Were they in the car? Were they outside? What was going on? Did they understand what was going to happen? Some of these kids didn't have a gun, didn't use a gun, didn't kill or intend to kill. And so are those crimes of irreparable corruption where you don't even commit a homicide? There's no way they can demonstrate that. Can they demonstrate they're incapable of rehabilitation when they have accomplished all that they are capable of doing in prison? I don't think so.
Some of the prosecutors that we have talked to really do paint some pretty heinous pictures from cases that they've gone through. Here's Genesee County Prosecutor Layton on one case.
For example, I'll just give you one example. There's a case of a fellow named Terry Morris. He shot six people to death back in 1987 in a house in Flint. He was 17 years old at the time. He opened fire on a person who he felt had disrespected him and then shot the others just so there should be no witnesses. It was as heinous a crime as Flint has ever seen. So we got his records from the prison, and they weren't all that impressive. And we made the determination that rehabilitation was not going to be something that he would be successful at, and that he needed to remain as a prisoner who faced life without the possibility of parole.
What are your thoughts on the prosecutor's assessment of that case?
We often hear that there's one case, and I would say there are a handful of them, that stand out because the 99.9% of these cases, of the 350-plus, there's a single victim. So, you know, you pick out one in which there are multiple victims, and those do stand out. And so I think what the U.S. Supreme Court said is they're all heinous, okay? So the question is, you know, on the front end, is it a crime of irreparable corruption? I certainly don't know the facts of this case or what went on or what was involved or who, you know, what the dynamic was at all. And in fact, that rarely comes up, never comes up in trial because the issue of the youth and what's been going on at that time were not relevant at that time. And then you look at who he is now. And when you say his record in prison is not particularly impressive, well, I have no idea what that means. Does that mean that he's had three misconducts for out of place? Or does it mean that you're not impressed by it, but certainly you can't say that it's impossible that he be rehabilitated? I mean, that's a very strong word. So is he the rare one in Michigan? I don't know. And if the prosecutors were picking one person and saying this is the rare one, that would be very different. But they're picking 250 people and saying they're all rare without exercising the discretion. And the court was very clear about this. No one's talking about that these weren't terrible crimes. The question is, what have they done since they've become grown up, since their brain has developed, since they got out of their dysfunctional environments? What have they done with themselves?
Deb, what has to happen for you to feel satisfied with the way Michigan prosecutors are handling these juvenile lifer cases?
Well, initially, many of the prosecutors said, well, we just didn't have enough time to carefully look at these cases. Well, we've now had almost a year since January. So what would have to happen is in counties like Saginaw and in counties like Macomb, where every single youth they're seeking life without parole in, and that simply is in defiance of the Supreme Court's very careful ruling that only the very rare youth that committed this kind of homicide should be subject to this sentence, I'd have them exercise their ethical obligations and look at these cases and determine and make some threshold showing. Ultimately, the judge will decide that's correct, but they can't punt this. It is incomprehensible to me that in Oakland County, where you have someone who has already served 53 years and has done everything possible, and in fact has had wardens recommend commutation on two occasions to the governor that he's done so well, that you would continue to seek to have this man who committed his crime when he was 16 die in prison without reviewing what is apparently there and exercising your discretion.
Deb, most of us, most of the people listening to us talk right now, don't have to worry about this because we and our relatives are not involved in serious crimes that could lead to a life sentence. Why should we care about this issue?
What we're doing here as a society is we're taking responsibility for children. Many children who we have failed. The majority of these children committed their offense when they were either expelled or suspended or unable to attend school. Many of them lived in places where they themselves were the victims of deep abuse, sexual or physical. These are not people who would not, when you know the circumstances, evoke your sympathy and your understanding of the limited choices they had and the deep pain that many of them were in. Now, did they react correctly? No. Did they deserve some punishment? Yes. But the minimum sentence everyone is going to get is 25 years. 25 years. And we know that adults, the majority in this state, who are charged with first degree, take pleas to much less and serve much less time. And these are children. And so we also know that they're not automatically going to get out. They still have to go to the parole board. And the parole board has to make a determination that they are no risk to public safety. And all we're talking about here is the opportunity to have someone after 25 years in prison, going in as a child, to be able to walk into the parole board and have the parole board evaluate whether this person is fully rehabilitated. That's all we're talking about here. And that minor step for children, I think everyone should care, because we're talking about some basic decency here.
Ann Arbor attorney Deborah LaBelle, director of the Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative with the ACLU. Deb, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Just to clarify, according to the State Appellate Defender Office, the total number of cases in which prosecutors are seeking to uphold life without parole sentences is 229 and not 250, as mentioned in the interview. That completes our series, Michigan's Juvenile Lifers, Who Gets a Second Chance? You can find all of our stories and interviews from this week on our webpage, michiganradio.org. And just today, we put up an interactive map that shows where all the cases are being handled across the state. All week, we spoke with prosecutors, with victims, with advocates, and law professors. We also had an exclusive interview with William Washington, the first and so far only juvenile lifer to have been given a second chance after he spent 41 years in prison.
I can't describe how 40 years is just wanting to be back with your family, sitting down eating a meal, you know, waking up in the morning, you know, good morning, greeting, you know. I hadn't realized how much I missed it.
Again, you can find William Washington's interview and all the others in the series at michiganradio.org. There are still hundreds of cases that have to make their way through the system. We'll keep watching.